Good afternoon. Harry will be absent, as you know, this afternoon. We are sitting in for him, and our guest is Mr. Joseph D. Hayne of Lebanon, and it says here he's been conducting an extensive research into the history of adventure radio serials. And we're going to be back in 1 minute and find out precisely what that means. Speaking of network radio, had a great deal to offer, except they had very little competition. Thank you, John. John Hoffman was worried that we didn't know that we were on yet. Let me introduce Mr. Joseph B. Hayne, Lebanon, and as we said in our opening remarks, he is conducting extensive research into the history of the adventure radio serial. I think I would rather put that just extensive research into the history of radio. Maybe have you confined your research to one particular area, Mr. Hayne?
Yes, there's so much that is involved in dealing with radio in general when you go back to its beginnings 40 years ago or more, and there are many people who are working in various areas of radio research that you have to limit yourself to some extent unless you have unlimited time and finances to do this. So my particular field is what I term the children's programs, and then we have limited even further to the extent that I call them the MAT, or Mystery Adventure Thriller type, usually the serials, that is 15-minute shows where you have action, suspense, mystery, and even some fine educational values. Something happens near the end of the program, a cliffhanger type ending, and the announcer would say, tune in tomorrow and find out what happened. So this is my specific area from 1928 up through 56, when the last of the children's shows went off the air.
Well, would you agree with me, or maybe you're not aware of this, that there are a great many people in radio holding responsible positions as far as programming was concerned that thought nobody but children listened to the radio, and they geared everything to about the nine-year-olds. So this could, if you wanted to accept it, put you in rather a large category that you would be researching at the moment. Every program practically that was on the air was supposed to be, with very few exceptions, geared to the very young. Now, I think they probably, what they probably meant was the IQ or the people that were listening to radio then preferred programs that were more appealing to the very young. Do you ever run across this in your study?
Well, I have found that many people, not necessarily juveniles or children, say from 6 to 16, listen to children's programs. Many older people listen. But then we find the opposite of this also to be true. As a matter of fact, in many of the polls that were taken and many of the serious studies, even at various universities, they found that children back in the 30s and the 40s, some of their favorite programs were generally termed adult programs. Jack Benny or Fred Allen or Fibber McGee and Molly or Gangbusters or any numerous other programs which normally would associate with adults listening to. As a matter of fact, I believe Eddie Cantor, if my memory serves me correctly, ranked near the top for many years in children's polls as being one of their favorite type programs. So you have adults listening to children's shows with great fervor and the opposite.
Somewhere somebody has to draw the line. Is that what you mean? Well, let's go back to your work. What motivated you to get into this, or what was the real reason that you felt this was important?
I think that I put this very well in an article I wrote for a tape organization in this country. There are various clubs of all kinds, and there are various clubs of people who correspond and so forth just by the magic of tape recording. And I wrote in this particular article that my interest in and my research into the juvenile mystery adventure thriller serials predates by nearly three decades the present nostalgic tidal wave. Actually, it goes back to 1937 when I was young and listening to Orphan Annie and Jack Armstrong and Tom Mix, and I took notes on these programs. And one evening in the fall of 1939, an adult program happened to hit the airwaves. I found more people who are dedicated to this one particular show than to any other show that I have ever run across, whether on the adult or the juvenile level. And I remember I used to read Sherlock Holmes every evening for about an hour, and this one particular evening, my dad happened to flick on the radio about 10 after 7, and I heard some English-speaking voices, and I thought at the time that maybe this was a Sherlock Holmes being brought to life, but it turned out to be Carlton E. Morse's I Love a Mystery. And as you also know, many of you who are listening, he did One Man's Family and some other fine shows. But I became so interested in radio through I Love a Mystery that I began taking consistently notes on all the programs, especially the children's programs. And this actually was the beginning of my research almost 30 years ago.
Well, I don't know whether you want to go back 30 years in your memory, but if you'll just hang on here for a minute, I'll see if we can't find out what your real long-range motive was here. And we'll be back in one moment. Yes, we're back on the comment now with Mr. Joseph P. Haynes of Lebanon. And we'll bring you up to date again. He's conducting extensive research into the history of the Venture Radio Serial, which, as you heard him say, started way back in his youth. And I'm wondering what you had. What was your long-range idea when you started taking notes and analyzing some of these programs?
Well, my original idea was twofold, maybe triplefold. First of all, I knew that the shows were extremely entertaining to me as a child, and as we found out, many adults listened in. And I said to myself, there must be more than just mere entertainment. There must be some educational values to these programs. Secondly, I had hoped eventually to do some type of history of these shows, how the networks developed this type of programming, include a great deal about the advertising, because advertising with premium offers and contests played a phenomenal role in the history of broadcasting, especially in the history of these shows, and then gather much of the material, that is the actual recordings and so forth of these programs, and put this all together and try to evolve a book that would be of interest to the public and also a definitive history to broadcasting people who are interested in this type of work. So those were my two major objectives, and they haven't changed over the years.
In other words, it was your purpose to write a history of the early days of radio.
As relates to the development of these juvenile serial programs.
Well, did you have any particular method of deciding what was a juvenile program and what was an adult program?
This is extremely difficult to draw the line. Actually, I think I have on my list now what many people would call adult shows, and I probably have also another list of adult shows, what some people would call juvenile shows. It is difficult, and it is not. If you think of what usually was programmed toward a child in the 6 to 16-year category, and you bring in the various elements, and you know how these particular scripts were edited and so on, you can limit it fairly well. But then you get into programs, for example, like The Shadow. Now, in interviewing Mr. Michelson, who syndicated The Shadow for many years, I said right out, he said, make sure you include this in your children's serials. Now, here we go off into one other tangent, if I may, and that is, by a serial, I do not strictly mean a 15-minute show that was continued every day. Now, The Shadow was a once-a-week half-hour. The Green Hornet, The Lone Ranger were half-hour programs, but they combined many of the elements of a serial with all types of cliffhanging surprises within a complete unit or one complete episode or show. So actually, you could subdivide this category into various divisions, but for simplification, I simply group them together. But getting back to The Shadow, he said, many of your shows, Joe, were actually oriented toward the family, and I think maybe that this would answer your original question as to who listened in to what. In a family-type show, both children and parents would listen in, and therefore, a lot of my shows would be characterized as almost family-type shows.
In other words, you take into consideration the hours of the day that children were available for our listening.
Correct. Mainly the 4 to 6 group during the week and in certain hours on Sunday. Very seldom beyond, say, 7:30, 8 or so at night when most children that age would be in bed going to school.
Well, that would sort of define your idea. as to how you arrived at programs for children. Now, did it occur to you at the time that the producers of most of these radio programs were gearing them to everybody?
Naturally, at the time that I heard them, as I was growing up, I did not know this. As I've done research through the years, I came to the conclusion that many of these shows were geared with a large audience in mind, a larger audience than just children.
How many people have you talked to that produced this type of program that you say was geared to the children?
Well, I have talked to people like Mr. Michelson and a gentleman who did a number of shows, for example, Mark Trail and I believe Tom Corbett, and a number of gentlemen who did a few of the serials, and then they did more of the adult-type show, like the American Album of Familiar Music and the Manhattan Merry-Go-Round. Let's see, I believe this fellow also did The Shadow. He also did the early One Man's Family. I've talked to people on both sides of the ladder, and the conclusion, actually, that you would have to draw, to some extent, are conflicting or complicated conclusions. Whatever ideas some of these fellows had in mind, you can't arrive at those ideas anymore because many of the old-time broadcasters are no longer with us. That is the sad part about it.
Have you talked to these people in recent years? I mean, have
yes,
any
the people have, I have just mentioned have been within the last year or two.
The last year or two.
Right.
What's their opinion about radio today? Is it a wasteland like somebody called television at one time?
Well, I think I could say very simply that many of the people that I have talked to, and this is also my opinion, feel that radio has lost much of its power, to put it in simple terms, the power of appealing to people and of entertaining them simply because it is narrowed down to the categories of a news media, of a service media with announcements. All this is very fine. A music, an entertainment, or an educational media also. And this is about it. You don't have your drama, you don't have comedy, you don't have thriller-type programs. Now, whether this all was just labeled in years past as strictly entertainment is one of the things that I question. I feel there were fine educational values there, just as people in television today feel there are. Yet when you read many of the critics of television today, they say there is very little there. I disagree with this, and I say that what we are missing in radio today is what many people, say 30, 40, 50 years of age, and many who were in broadcasting, as you have just asked me, they miss this too. They wish that it would come back as far as it is possible to bring it back.
As an entertainment medium, do you mean that? I mean, is this what you're saying? Come back as a medium of entertainment?
Well, whether it would entertain the people today, for example, I've been asked many times about the juvenile or the teenage audience. Sophistication has arisen today with these people since the atomic era, with everything that they're able to see on television, with the advanced studies even in high school that are covering college material, formerly college material. How much could they enjoy this and then carrying it to the adult level? Would they really be entertained after 10, 15 years of television entertainment? I think they would to a certain extent. You would never know unless it was tried on a wholesale basis. But we are leaving out of television one key factor that radio, its greatest power, and that was the imagination, the ability to capture one's imagination.
We'll talk more about that in one moment. We're back. Joe, you made one statement about the sophistication of radio and television today as compared to a few years back. Let me ask you this question. Do you think that the average person, the average youngster or adult today, listens to the radio or watches television with the sole idea in mind of being educated?
With the sole idea of being educated?
Yes.
No, I would say that primarily on television, it's for entertainment or relaxation. The average working man coming home, whatever job he is in, may not find too much constructive or too much of a artistic nature, meaning that in a general sense, for one is creating, he comes home, he is tired or he may be bored with his work. Even in large offices, he wants to be entertained. Radio is an information or a service media. It's entertaining through music and so forth, but they are missing the elements, the great elements that tie in with literature and so forth, the educational elements, the elements that go with great art. And radio certainly produced, I think, very many programs that you could call great, great from the viewpoint of art or drama or literature.
Would you name a few of those programs?
Well, I'm thinking, for example, a lot of these on radio also were carried later into television. A lot of the various playhouses that existed down through the years on radio. Now, here again, I must admit my memory to some extent is going to be a little bit off because my major interest is always along the juvenile programs. Getting into programs that entertained and also educated, I think I mentioned two, the American Album of Familiar Music and also the Manhattan Merry-Go-Round. Of course, you always had the operas being broadcast over radio, as you do today. I have some lists before me, as I'm trying to grope for some other names. Most of these, though, are mystery-adventure-type programs, which would be on the entertainment level.
Well, let me ask you one question before we get into that. Did any of these people that you interviewed that were responsible for some of these programs ever mention the fact that a program had to have a message, whether it was in purely out-and-out comedy or whether it was an adventure series or whether it was a program that contained a cliffhanger? Can you recall in any of your interviews that anybody mentioned anything in regard to that particular point?
By message, I'm thinking now of two possibilities. Do you mean message by commercial message, or do you mean a message in the program itself?
Within the program itself. Now, not the commercial message. Mm-hmm. Don't confuse
that. In the program itself.
In other words, when the program was over, whether it was an adult or whether it was a youngster or whether it was somebody in between, that they got something in particular out of that.
Yes. This was a definite factor in the shows. I think a simple and easy way to answer it is in making up some tapes, which I hope we might be able to do on the program, I have included a segment here from a Jack Armstrong program in 1939. Now, this was before World War II. And without saying anything more about it, because it will be a giveaway, if you listen to that segment of Jack Armstrong, I think you will get the message very clearly, and it will answer the question that you're asking. Now, you can carry this over into almost any one of these children's programs, and again, I'm going to always come back to this, because if I confine my remarks to this, I will be on much safer ground. But messages were written into the script in another sense. For example, the Superman program. Now, everyone hears that would laugh and say, how could that rate as any kind of program except fantasy or entertainment? But no, it was one of the leading shows on radio that put forth in a message of intolerance or fighting against prejudice. It received a number of awards from Ohio State University in the children's category. So here is a way-out example of Superman actually creating good and getting across a message, and I think this answers your question.
It does, very well. We'll be back in just one moment. We're talking to Mr. Joseph Hain of Lebanon, who is conducting an extensive research into the history of adventure radio serials. How many years have you been at this?
Well, the years that I took notes, you couldn't classify strictly as research. To one extent it was, but around 1949 or 50, when I was away studying for a number of years in college, my material remained at home, and one day, about a decade later, when I returned home, it was all gone through some unintentional house cleaning. So about 1964, January, I had heard of the Broadcast Pioneers History Project, and I began again from the beginning, from scratch. And you could say then it's about 39 or 40 months I've been at this, as much as my time has allowed me to put on it.
You know, some of these things go back in history pretty far, Joe. Has it been difficult to get around to some of these people that had anything to do with these programs and the programs themselves?
Right. This is almost the most difficult research I can imagine talking to many people in broadcasting one could do, because many people listening day after day to soap operas or juvenile shows just took them for granted. They were intensely interested because they became identified with certain people and they knew them better than even their friends, so to speak. But the material itself could not be saved by many of the networks or the station because it's too much of a backlog. So the day when you're trying to track down what happened in the 1930s on Orphan Annie or in the 40s on Don Winslow or Jack Armstrong, the material is very limited. It is very difficult to find, even information in the trade papers and magazines. They did not review or write that much about these programs. And the people themselves, as I mentioned way back, many of the old-timers have died. I've missed many fellows by a matter of a couple months. By the time I got to them, they had just passed away, and their memories are gone forever.
Let me ask you one other thing. I think maybe there might be somebody in our radio audience, Joe, that would have a question, but I have one before. How many writers did you talk to in your travels and your research?
I've talked to maybe a half dozen of the writers, and they really, you put your finger on the key. Now, I have written to many of the writers, and I've gotten very fine cooperation from the fellows who wrote these shows, because if anyone saved material from the programs, I think that's what you were leading into, it would be the writers.
Well, what I really had in mind was, did you have the opportunity, or did you ask these people what they had in mind, other than the theme that they were going to follow, in writing these programs?
Yes, I have asked them, and usually the answer broke down into these categories. Number one, they were trying to write as good a show as they could, as every writer, whatever medium he was writing in. Number two, they were limited, though, because in the early 30s, various women's groups across the country objected to some of the violence on the children's shows, and in some it was there. And as a result, the networks put some very stringent rules, and especially through the later 30s and 40s, and they had codes which a lot of the writers had to adhere to, and this made it very difficult sometimes to get across some of the ideas the way they wanted to express them. Also, there were limitations from, naturally, the advertising agencies and also the sponsors.
I wanted you to bring that out. A writer didn't have a free hand at all.
No, in many cases he did not, and it is amazing to find the quality and some of the fine points on these shows when you consider all the limitations that these writers had.
Joe, we have a caller. Let's see, maybe you can help him. Yes, this is Comment. Do you have a question for Mr. Hayne? Are you there? Hello? Yes, are you there?
Yeah, I was just wondering, after all is said and done, was there ever a program more popular than Amos and Andy?
Well, that's a good question to answer, Joe.
Well,
this would be a matter of ratings, but ratings don't always tell the true story.
No, this, again, is out of my field, which I keep emphasizing, but in talking to radio people, for example, in Lebanon, some people there said you could walk down the entire city streets a mile or two, go from house to house, when Amos and Andy were extremely popular, and listen to each segment as you went along and never miss one word. So I think that would help to answer your question.
I think so. Don't you think, though, really, that you could categorize Amos and Andy as a children's program? Wasn't that material good enough to put in that class?
Well, I would say that it would be aimed at the family. Therefore, you would have both adults and certainly children listening. But this is more in the comedy or variety type program, don't you think?
Yes.
Well, I'm trying to limit myself strictly to the mystery, adventure, thriller, the action type show, because there were so many children's programs where they just told stories and so forth. You could work on this for probably 100 years if you included everything in one category.
Very good. Yes, you're on, Comment.
I have a question about Amos and Andy. One of the producers of that show, was he local to this area? I know that supposedly he went to Susquehanna. I can't say his name. It begins with a C. But, or creator. What, I don't know if he was a producer or what. But was he from this general area? And he's still active in television, you know, producing shows and so forth. Thank you.
No, I wouldn't know. Do you?
No,
I don't recall who the people were that
I'm sorry, I would not know that.
Produced the Amos and Andy show. I do know that their scripts, the Amos and Andy scripts, for the most part, were written by Correll and Gosden.
Themselves.
It was their idea. The announcer on the show, I forget his name, was part owner of the idea. But who else was behind the scenes, if anybody was, I'm sure I don't know. We'll be back in just one moment. Yes, let's get back to one question for me. In your research, what was the most popular adventure series as far as you could determine?
Well, as far as I've been able to determine so far, it started just a little bit after Amos and Andy. And as a matter of fact, reading through Variety and some other journals just the other evening, 28, 29, 30, this started in 30. I'm leaving the name to the end of my little talk because maybe some people out there will be able to deduce this for themselves. But starting in 30, there were really no adventure serials per se, maybe one or two scattered ones. This program was tried more or less experimentally in Chicago, obviously, where most of the serials and soap operas originated. And it caught on so well within this limited territory that it finally went to the network. And, of course, I'm talking about Little Orphan Annie.
That was the big...
That was so popular for at least a half a dozen years that in the ratings, it may not have necessarily rated one. Now, that may sound as a contradiction, but it was so popular at least the first 3 or 4 years that almost every other serial was patterned, even though it involved boys, since Little Orphan Annie mainly, you would say, would emphasize the fact that it was pitched toward a girl audience. It really wasn't. But all the other serials copied that to some extent, at least in the beginning.
Very good. Yes, you're on comment. You have a question?
Yes, good afternoon. I just wanted to mention that during the 30s and the 40s on radio, I feel that one of the most important things that is often overlooked with these serial-type programs on the radio was their music. The theme songs and the background music created about one-third to one-half of the interest in the program. You could always tell what program was coming on by the music that was being played. And a lot of this music was played on the Hammond organ, and it was just about the same time that the Hammond organ became popular was through these radio programs. Some of the good players that played on these serial-type programs were later to become very famous as organists, such as George Wright and Ethel Smith and Don Baker and some of those. I remember listening to, I'd say, 100 or more programs, and I could always recognize the program by the theme song music. So I wonder if this gentleman has any comments about the music that was used on these programs.
Very good.
That is a very, very excellent point, and it's too bad we didn't bring that out before. As a matter of fact, on one of the tapes I made up, I have themes here from as many as I could get together, and the theme, as you said, actually probably was the most characteristic, the most distinguishing thing about the entire program. You heard that theme, whatever show it was, you immediately identified it.
I don't think the writers of some of these shows are going to be very friendly toward those remarks, but nevertheless, it's probably true. We'll be back in one moment. If your research, then the writers, the producers, the directors, or the people who are responsible for these shows, ever bring out the fact that radio was very casual listening?
Yes, I believe they have, or at least implied this. The radio was casual listening. At the same time, if I'm interpreting casual correctly, it was serious listening, but this was pitched again at certain times and at a certain audience, and when they felt that this type of audience was available. In other words, I'm explaining this now in relation to serious type of programming other than just entertaining.
Now, what I'm trying to bring out here is the fact that a great many people could tell you any theme song that came along and what the name of the program was, but there were mighty few of them could tell you the content of the program itself.
This is, I believe, true and also not so true. I'm amazed in talking to some people, especially in just mentioning some of the soap operas, about which I fortunately do not know too much. This is a field in itself, since there were hundreds of soap operas, but a number of people from my experience recall the cast, can even recall some of the plotting. Now, this is amazing when you consider that a lot of times somebody like Bob Hardy Andrews, who has admitted this to me and in his book, he was writing 6 or 7 soap operas and would just interchange scripts and change a few things around, again, because of the pressure on him to produce. He didn't necessarily want to write this way, but sometimes he was forced to.
In the early days, we had some surveys made to find out exactly how popular the programs themselves were, the content of the programs. And it was amazing, the people that could go into fine detail, but it was more amazing to the people that used to put the wrong show with the wrong theme song. I don't know, how much time do we have to go, John?
30 seconds.
Well, let's take that 30 seconds to tell you that Mr. Hayne will be back in the second portion of comment. We're going to play a couple of tapes that might stir up some nostalgia in your memory of the radio back in the early 30s, late 20s, and 40s. So we'll turn the proceedings over to John Hoffman at this point and be back about 12 minutes after 2 o'clock. Comment part two, our guest is the same as part one, Mr. Joseph P. Hayne of Lebanon, who is conducting extensive research into the history of adventure radio serials. Joe, we have a nice lineup of theme songs here, and I think when we come back after just one moment, we might play these two or three at a time and then talk about the trouble you had getting some of these things on tape. I know it wasn't easy. Joe, we have quite a lineup of theme songs or theme music. Let's play these two or three at a time and tell us what trouble you did have or what you had to do, how many arms you had to twist to get some of these things so you get them all on tape. Would you like to do that?
Yes, John.
Atomic Ralston Stationers are on the air. And from out of the west comes Tom Mix, America's favorite cowboy, and his brother horse, Tony.
Start the morning with hot Ralston and his early limousine. Grab the form of fill at breakfast, give the cowboy energy. It's delicious and nutritious, need a golden western wing. Take a bit from home, go and tell your mom, hot Ralston takes TV.
Captain Midnight! Yes, Captain Midnight. Brought to you every day, Monday through Friday, by the makers of Ovaltine, the world's largest selling food drink.
The Adventures of Frank Merriwell. Tonight's episode, Frank Confesses in the Dark.
So there you have three of them. Joe, Tom Mix, Captain Midnight, and Frank Merriwell.
Three of the most famous, especially number one, Tom Mix, sponsored by Ralston, as you heard Tom Mix sing in the song. And some years back, writing to the Ralston Company to show you the troubles, they were out looking for a number of years of people who had saved any of this material. And I think one or two episodes were transcribed from home recording discs many years back. The quality was so poor you could hardly hear it. So then running down other fellows and tracking them down out in Hollywood and so forth, and we came up with one episode that was buried in the ground. I don't know the complete story, but that's actually what had happened. Now, Captain Midnight, this was a very sad case. One of the fellows who played the villain for many years, one of the chief villains, had about 60 or 70, and this is a duplicate of what happens many times. And talking to another old collector of radio one day on a plane flight down to Houston, Texas, he said, gee, I have a lot of these in my basement. When we get down there, we'll call back to my mother and have her check them out. And they did, and they found out that they were all warped, and well, there went that lead. So the ones I got was through a private collector, and I don't actually know where he got them, so... Now, Frank Merriwell, the episode you heard there is the exact one I believe they used in May of 66, a year ago, when they did that special on broadcasting on television. And this, again, came through an old sound engineer or some old collector who had saved it.
Very good. Let's try some more.
Adventures of Red Rider. From out of the West comes America's famous fighting cowboy. Here's up to another thrill-packed adventure of Sky King.
Super Delicious Cereal presents
The Adventures of Superman.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. able to leap tall buildings at a single bound.
Look, up in the sky. It's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Superman.
Well, Red Rider, Sky King, and Superman.
There's a little story in Red Rider. One gentleman wrote, produced, directed the show for most of the time it was on, and it was mainly on the Pacific Coast. This is a good example of what happens many times over. He had saved the material and the recordings and scripts for many years. About 6 months before I was able to get to him, he destroyed all this material because keeping this in various places of storage, the prices become astronomical. Now, Sky King, we could track down through one of the agencies, and Superman, of course, was played by Bud Collier for all the years, and we were able to get some of the material through Bud Collier.
I think we have a call here. Would you like to take one? Yes, you're on comment.
This is a very nostalgic program. I just love it. But I was wondering, does your guest know the name of the theme song, I Love a Mystery?
Yes, the theme, I Love a Mystery, was Valse Triste by Sibelius.
What was that again?
Valse, V-A-L-S-E, Triste, T-R-I-S-T-E, by Gene Sibelius.
Mm-hmm. I wish they had you on again another day, too.
Thank you.
I think we can arrange that. Let's go back to the theme song.
I'll kill it! A fiery horse with a speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty high silver! The Lone Ranger.
With his faithful Indian companion Tonto, the daring and resourceful masked rider of the plains led the fight for law and order in the early western United States. Nowhere in the pages of history can one find a greater champion of justice. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the past come the thundering hoofbeats of the great horse Silver. The Lone Ranger rides again.
One, two, let's go, big fellow. I'll kill you. Oh!
Circus. The Lone Ranger is making a personal appearance. I don't know whether Tonto is with him or not.
The history of the Lone Ranger is very interesting. The fellow you heard there, I'm sure some people will know, is probably Brace Beamer, the last gentleman to play the Lone Ranger, who died about a year or so ago. And I just was able to receive some recordings of the two fellows who played it previously, one being George Seaton of Pearlberg Seaton Movie Productions, and the other fellow being Earl Glauser, who died and then was replaced by Brace Beamer.
Mm-hmm. Jimmy Allen, that sounded a little thin. I think that was recorded several times before you got it, wasn't it?
It went way back to 1935, and I think it came from the original disc, but that brings another problem among Many we have, and that is some of the discs, as we said, were buried, found in basements. You cleaned them up, and when you transcribed the old discs with the poor recording equipment of those days onto tape, it sounds pretty bad, but it's the best you can do sometimes.
We'll be back in just one moment with more of your famous old theme songs.
From the heart of the jungle comes a savage cry of victory. This is Tarzan, Lord of the Jungle. From the black core of dark Africa, land of enchantment, mystery, and violence, comes one of the most colorful figures of all time, transcribed from the immortal pen of Edgar Rice Burroughs. Tarzan, the bronze white son of the jungle. And now, in the very words of Mr. Burroughs, the story of Gold Coast robbery.
Yes, it's Dick Tracy, protector of law and order.
Well, those two famous ones there. Did anybody ever ask you, or did you try to find out what that code, if it's spelled, really spelled out anything?
And Dick Tracy, no, I never looked into that, but it might be an interesting trivia research fact to find out.
Tarzan shouldn't have been such a problem. Was that taken from the movie soundtrack?
The voice on air, the yell, I believe, was. Most of the Tarzan recordings is with Edgar Rice Burroughs' son out in Tarzania, California. And some of the material also is in the hands of the private collectors again.
Okay, would you like to answer a couple of phone calls here, I think, before they get too impatient? Yes, you're on, Tom,
Ed. Yes, thank you, Harry. Or John, I guess it's... this is very interesting. Now, I have a question. The Lone Ranger came from WXYZ, I believe, in Detroit, did it not?
Yes.
All right. Now, also, I think Green Hornet came from Detroit. Now, was this common practice in those days that some of these programs of this type came from local independent, not necessarily independent, but local stations around the country?
Well, WXYZ in the beginning, I believe, was independent, and the fact that the Green Hornet and Lone Ranger came out of the same studio was because James Jewell, who has never received the publicity or credit he actually deserves, developed a whole theater of actors out of Detroit with WXYZ under George Trendle and Campbell and Raymond Muir, the actually a brilliant lawyer, one of the most brilliant of all time. And as a result, many of the players would switch from the Lone Ranger to the Green Hornet. And as you hear these recordings, you can see it is the exact same people, just switching various roles.
I don't know whether you pointed this out to the audience or not. I found this very surprising. I never realized it until just very recently. The Lone Ranger's real name was... what is it now? I've forgotten already.
Well, the one we played was Brace Beamer.
I mean his name in the story.
Reed, I believe.
Pardon?
Reed, his last name.
Yes, and the Green Hornet was supposed to be his great-great-grandson or something of the kind.
That's right. There was a relationship there. Actually, the fellow who wrote it, Fran Stryker, wrote many other shows. I'd say he was one of the most prolific and finest writers of these type programs, and he worked it out that way, that there was a relationship between the Black Beauty of the Green Hornet and then Silver the Horse. Right down the line, there are about six or seven similarities.
Another question. I remember years back when I was a kid, I had gotten a book from the library called Inside Radio, and this had dealt with all these stories of this kind. Have you ever seen this book, and do you know where you can get a copy today?
No, I have found almost nothing in books on these children's programs, having gone through some of the large network libraries. There's very little been written. That's what makes it so difficult to come up with information.
I got it from the Enoch Troy Free Library in Baltimore, and when I was in high school, I wrote to the publisher, and at that time, which was in 1949, it was out of print.
Uh-huh.
So I guess
I believe it is in one of the large... the title is familiar, but if it had any information on children's programs, it was very limited, believe me.
Well, this is more radio in general.
Yes. I have seen the book. You're correct.
We're going to be back in just one moment.
Quaker Pop Tweet Sparkies brings you Terry and the Pirates.
Andu, the magician. Frank Chandler, known in the Far East as Chandu the Magician, is playing a dangerous game. He has deceived the malignant Rockstar into thinking him an Egyptian sorcerer, and Rockstar has engaged him to perform two feats of black magic. First, to rid the world of Frank Chandler, and second, to cast a spell over his hidden prisoner, Robert Regan. Chandu the Magician.
Adventurers, attention! Fall in for adventure parade! The Mutual Broadcasting System cordially invites all adventurers from 6 to 60 to join in its parade of the world's most famous stories. Stories of action,
mystery,
and adventure. And here is your host and storyteller, the leader of Adventure Parade, John Gibbs.
Well, there's your Terry and the Pirates, Chandu the Magician, and the Adventure Parade. Some sound a little hairy in places, Joe. Did you have trouble with these?
Yes. Chandu the Magician, I think that's the 47, 48, 49 series. Actually, it was on in the early 30s. I think it was the first electrical transcription series, and the advertising and all that went with it, I think it was actually the most famous show of that time. And Adventure Parade, I would like to add, was one of the finest educational shows. It was sustaining. It received many awards. They dramatized the classics, Treasure Island, the very famous books for children. And one man did most of the roles, John Griggs. Phenomenal performance by one fellow.
We have a few phone calls here. Yes, you're on comment.
I'm wondering if you just remember the program that came on late in the evening about 11 o'clock. It's called The Orange Lantern. And it would come on with a weird Chinese gong sound. And you know, that held my family as long as it was on the air. I would go up to the steps up. The program was over my 13-year-old daughter just taking steps to hear the thing. If someone had to get up at night, they'd be looking in the corners. You know, it really was a wonderful program, and I can't find anyone who remembers it. Do you folks remember it?
Yes, I don't know if it would be classified. I know very little about it because, like you, I've been trying to find information on it. I talked to an old German actor in New York who actually played the show, and we went through his notebooks, and he told me, I said, now, what was this Orange Lantern about? He said it was about mystery and adventure and suspense, I think with a group of people or some family, and that's all I can recall at the moment. I believe I have his remarks on tape, but this fascinates me too, this program, believe me.
Yes, you're on comment.
Yeah?
Yes?
There's a gentleman collecting material on old-time radio, and I've come across a book here, a first edition by Robert West. It's titled, So You're Going on the Air. It's a popular guide to the realm of radio. And that dates 1933. I've gone through this book, and it's very interesting. I don't know whether it'd be of interest to him or not.
I believe that I may have seen it among the hundreds of books that I've looked at. The title is very familiar. Again, offhand, I don't think you have it there. I don't think there is much information in there about the children's programs, going back on my memory.
No, there's not much in about children. This fellow is Robert West, the director of the Radio Arts Guild of America.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much for calling. We have one more call here. Yes, you're on comment.
I think this is the most interesting program that I have heard in quite a while, and I certainly hope you get your guests back soon. It brings back a great many memories for me, and I'd like to ask him several questions. They're just short ones, and I'd like to hang on while he answers. First of all, can you tell me who starred as Jack Armstrong?
You mean who wrote it or who acted in it?
Who acted in it? Who played the part?
Well, from my research, it was Jim Amici, Don Amici's brother. Other people that I have talked to who have done research in this claims it was claim it was another gentleman, but I've never been able to verify this so far.
How about Captain Midnight?
Captain Midnight was played by Ed Prentice, who also did many of the soap operas. The last year, I think Paul Barnes played Captain Midnight.
And Dick Tracy?
Was played by a number of gentlemen. If you hold on just for one more second, we'll give you the exact names. I have some notes here. This one eludes me. Dick Tracy by Ned Weaver. He was the first fellow way back in the 30s. And then we had, in the 40s, Matt Crowley, who played a number of other roles, Barry Thompson and Dean Carlton. Those are the fellows I have for Dick Tracy.
Uh-huh. What about Hop Harrigan?
Hop Harrigan? Just a second, we'll check that for you. I can tell you Tank Tinker was Jackson Beck, who did the announcing there on Superman, and he also has done a lot of the commercials that you see on television. Chester Stratton did Hop Harrigan as the very first. Then Albert Alley, who wrote a number of shows, he acted in it, he also wrote it. He also did Hop for a number of years. I believe those are the two major ones for Hop Harrigan.
I know that for about an hour and a half, no one was allowed to talk to me while those programs were on. Do you recall the Moylan sisters? They were two little girls who sang, and their combined voices were supposed to produce three separate sounds. I wonder, I'm going to hang up as soon as I ask you this question, but I wondered if you remember them and if you could tell me whatever happened to them. And thank you very much.
I do remember them, but I know, other than remembering them and having heard, I know very little actually about them. Thank you very much.
Jim, we have some other theme songs here I know would stir up some nostalgia among a great many listeners, especially at this time of day. Would you play a...
And now for our sequel to Stella Dallas. This is The Right to Happiness, brought to you by CBS Radio.
Some memories right off. Stella Dallas, Right to Happiness, and Whispering Street. How did you come by those, Jim?
Well, about the same way we have come across others, through agencies, through private collectors, and so forth. And again, I have an interest in all the shows other than the children's shows, but primarily I'm getting these for historical organizations who are gathering the material, and at the same time, I employ these to trade, actually, in the strict sense of the word, for some of the juvenile shows which fellows have, which I would like.
You mean trading goes on in this world of research, too?
Yes, very much so.
Let's try the rest of these.
That's right, when you add everything up.
And now CBS Radio brings you Ma Perkins. Now, CBS Radio presents Young Dr. Malone, featuring Sandy Becker.
story of Mary Marlin by Jane Cruzenberry. Brought to you each weekday at the same time.
Well, that should bring up some memories. Ma Perkins, young Dr. Malone, Mary Marlin, you had an interesting observation there about a couple of them, Jim.
Well, in regard to those being CBS shows, and also the Ma Perkins and Young Dr. Malone and Whispering Streets, I believe these were 1960 vintage, and the last day, I can't recall the exact date offhand, the last day that these soap operas were broadcast. So this theme is taken from the last time they ever graced the airwaves.
The Swan Song, right?
That's correct.
All right. Are there any more on that page?
Ivory Soap. 99 and 44, 100% pure. Now, life can be beautiful. Ivory Soap's own story, written for you by Carl Bixby and Don Becker. Time now for Spry's double feature treat of the day. Aunt Jenny's thrilling real-life story with Lanny Ross.
And fish fillet broiled to appetizing perfection with Spry.
Familiar music there. I don't know how many people remember what the stories were about, but they sure remember the theme song. Mary Marlin, that was a Debussy composition. I couldn't get anything out of Life Can Be Beautiful. You don't happen to know what that was?
Offhand, I don't. We could look it up and come back with the answer after the next themes are played.
Aunt Jenny's real-life stories, I don't think there was much of a theme there, was it? Except going away. There seemed to be one. I wonder if we could play the rest of them. Are there three more on there, John?
The Columbia Broadcasting System presents This Life Is Mine, written by Eddie Richmond and Lynn Stone. The story of a family which meets the challenge of this changing world with two conflicting points of view.
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle. Couples like lovable, impractical Lorenzo Jones and his devoted wife, Belle. Lorenzo's inventions have made him a character to the town, but not to Belle, who loves him. Their struggle for security is anybody's story. But somehow with Lorenzo, it has more smiles than tears.
The Road of Life, brought to you, transcribed by Ivory Soap. Now celebrating its 75th anniversary as America's favorite. The New Does brings you The Guiding Light, created by Erna Phillips.
Lineup, Jim, but what happened to Our Gal Sunday?
I think Our Gal Sunday has disappeared for the moment.
Wasn't that the one that just said a ukulele or something?
Yes, we checked back for you on Life Can Be Beautiful. I don't see any theme listed in notes that I have here from someone else, but I do see that one of the first announcers was Ralph Edwards, and that's quite a nostalgic note.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Everybody thinks of Ralph Edwards as This Is Your Life, which came much later. John, you take over.
Show brought to you by Rinso, the only soap that contains solium.
I want to wish you a very Merry Christmas to you, your families, and the finest New Year ever.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
Good night, folks. See you next Sunday.
The Lucky Strike program starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Phil Harris, Rochester, Dennis Day, and yours truly, John Wilson.
Program with Fibber McGee and Molly. The makers of Johnson's Wax Products for Home and Industry present Fibber McGee and Molly with Bill Thompson, Bill Gordon, Arthur Q. Bryan, Jess Kirkpatrick, and me, Harlow Wilcox. The script is by Don Quinn and Phil Leslie. Music by the King's Men and Billy Mills Orchestra. Tonight, folks, 60 minutes of fun and music brought to you by Ipana Toothpaste and Style Hepatica. Ipana for the smile of beauty, Style Hepatica for the smile of health. Fun with our star comedian, Fred Allen. Music with Peter Van Steeden. New features, new laughs. It's Town Hall tonight. Listen to that crowd here, Fred Allen, as he heads his weekly parade to the old town hall. Fred's leading the band with an adding machine, followed by those unwelcome additions to the drama, the mighty Alan Archer. Let's join that happy throng, folks. Everybody's going. Everybody's going. Here they come. Leon Quintuplet.
Aren't the babies on exhibition this evening, Doctor?
No, madam. The little tots are busy at their radios. It's town hall tonight.
Farmer, what's the idea of putting a radio in your hen house, Clem?
Hens can learn plenty about laying eggs from that island, Deb. It's town hall tonight.
G-Man, a feast is hardly a taste for the G-Man lady.
It sure is. Don't see. My radio, Mr. Hilburn, at town hall tonight.
Gee, that's about it. It's been a wonderful afternoon. Nostalgia for a lot of people, and especially me. Been around a long time and can remember most of these things. But let us invite you back sometime, and we can talk more about your particular specialty, the adventure series for children. And I think anything you have, anything else, material, or that you might have on any other series might interest a great many people in radio. Maybe you better expand it.
I think we better, John. Thank you very much.
Right, now back to John.